welcome to the New Books and Philosophy channel of the New Books Network. My name is Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the channel with Carrie Figder. Carrie is associate professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. Today, my guest is Professor L.A. Paul. Her new book is titled Transformative Experience. It's just been published by Oxford University Press. L.A. Paul is professor of philosophy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and a professorial fellow at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. We typically make decisions based on a projection of their likely outcome with respect to the things that we value. We seek to maximize or enhance the things we think are good and minimize what we think is bad. But sometimes we are faced with a decision where we must choose whether to undergo an experience that will likely transform us in some fundamental ways, perhaps even change our sense of what's valuable or important. Indeed, sometimes we must choose whether to, in effect, become a different kind of person. How should decisions like that be made? In Transformative Experience, L.A. Paul examines a range of cases where agents must choose whether or not to be transformed in fundamental ways that they, the agents, cannot grasp in advance of the transformation. As it turns out, choices of this transformative kind are far more common than we might think. Transformative Experience is a fascinating, sharply focused exploration of a common phenomenon that is surprisingly under-theorized. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, L.A. Paul.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing today?
I'm good, thanks.
Thank you for joining us on New Books in Philosophy.
Thanks for inviting me.
Sure. And thank you, listeners, for listening to the podcast. My guest today is L.A. Paul, and we'll be talking about her new book, Transformative Experience, which is recently published by Oxford University Press. Now, in this book, L.A. explores choice making under the peculiar, but as it turns out, not uncommon circumstance where the agent must choose whether or not to be transformed in some significant way. In these cases, it looks as if our ordinary and intuitive models of rational choice and rationality more generally seem to run out. So how should we choose in these cases? This book is tightly focused. It's philosophically deep, and there's a whole lot to talk about. But before we get into those details, L.A., why don't you begin by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Okay, so I entered philosophy really when I entered graduate school. I went to Princeton for my PhD in philosophy and studied with David Lewis. But this, I want to say a little bit about how I got to this project, because a lot of my earlier work has been in metaphysics with a focus on figuring out the nature of causation and properties and time. And this book is really, in some ways, quite different. It's not that it's different from how I normally think about things, because I've been thinking about these issues for about 20 years, really ever since I thought I would go to graduate school. But it's different in the way that it treats the topics and the way it approaches questions. I always enjoyed formal and technical work, but I was also always extremely interested in experience, in ways of approaching phenomenology, and in aesthetics. And before I went to grad school, in fact, I went to India, studied meditation and Buddhist philosophy, and was thinking maybe I wanted to study non-Western philosophy generally, although that is definitely not the direction that I took. But I always felt like a philosophical approach to understanding the way that each of us as individuals sort of, you know, thinks about reality and how we kind of confront reality in order to construct a kind of meaningful sort of sense of who we are and what we're doing basically in the world is really important. And I want to do that as a metaphysician, basically. And that's always been my focus. Okay. And then after tackling these questions from a sort of more traditional causal and kind of temporal perspective, well, I had a baby. And then I realized, wow, there was a sort of real life experience that sort of pulled together all of, or at least many of the different puzzling things that I'd been thinking about in philosophy in a kind of distinctive way that really brought, could bring out the kinds of questions I feel like philosophically I've been wanting to ask for a long time. So the project, basically, which is developed in the book, is the result of the way that I want to try to bring together insights from the way that we think about consciousness and the role of experience and imagination in conjunction with powerful mathematical tools from decision theory that we can use in order to plan our lives and, in particular, to think about our future selves. And I try to draw together natural ways of thinking about imagination and ourselves and authenticity together with sort of formal tools from analytic philosophy to explore how maybe we want to actually live our lives as agents sort of attempting to realize ourselves and our goals over the course of a lifetime. So that's really the project.
Well, that's wonderful. Just one quick sort of before we get into the details of the book, I wanted to ask just sort of a broadly now sort of methodological question. I take it that many of our listeners will know some of the earlier work that you mentioned at the beginning when you were telling us about your philosophical background, the book on causation, for example, some of the stuff on metaphysics and time. This does seem like a departure in that it has a it's not only is the book interested in a certain kind of decision theoretic question, but there's a sort of moral concern I think that drives the book. Is there any connection that you see between the concerns that are taken up in the Transformative Experience book and some of the philosophical questions that you've explored previously that have an empirical dimension?
Yes. So I think there are a lot of potential empirical connections, as well as I think that the work that I've been doing has been influenced in some ways by empirical work. And one of the exciting things for me now is that I have a grant from the Templeton Foundation that's allowing me to pursue a number of collaborative projects with psychologists and cognitive scientists, as well as sociologists. And in particular, I'm doing some work with Fiery Cushman, who's a psychologist at Harvard, and he's very interested in moral transformation. So he's been exploring basically ways that people respond to morally transformative experiences. And we're collaborating on the ways in which exploring the sort of psychological dimension of these things can actually come back and hopefully have interesting new implications for philosophy. And so not in a way where I just kind of go and ask the psychologist what they think and then they tell me what to think and I bring it back. That's kind of disciplinary imperialism in a way that I'm not really – that's not really my approach. The thought is rather that we're really building a project together, and I'm finding that extremely exciting. There are a number of other psychologists. I'm also working with June Gruber at Colorado, Paul Bloom, who's at Yale, and then Josh Tenenbaum and Tomer Ullman at MIT. And Josh and Tomer are cognitive scientists, and the dimension of the project that we're working on together involves collaborating on exploring our intuitive theories of ourselves. So cognitive scientists are really interested in lots of ways in which we think first personally about things. And there's been a lot of work on intuitive theories of mind and intuitive theories of physics. But what I'm really interested in, I think what Josh and Tomer are interested in, is thinking about how we might model our future selves and how we think about who we're going to make ourselves into and how we try to act and sort of, you know, control what we do in order to develop ourselves in particular ways. And so I think that's also empirically and formally a really exciting development.
Well, excellent. Let me, I want to return to some of what you just said, especially about morally transformative experiences. But first, why don't we, if it's okay with you, just sort of try to get the idea of a transformative experience on the table. So this will sort of lead us into just the way the book begins. So the book begins with a fanciful sort of thought experiment and then develops it further by looking at a well-known but nonetheless fanciful thought experiment. I'm thinking particularly of the way the book begins with a thought experiment involving vampires and then gets further developed by a reconsideration of a familiar thought experiment from Frank Jackson and his color scientist named Mary. Can you run us through just sort of the general contours of the idea of a transformative experience or the kind of choice we have to make under those conditions?
Sure. Let me start out. I'll give you a couple of a couple of quick definitions, and then I'll give you the examples to see how to work with them. So I introduced two notions involving transformative experience in my book. I talk about an epistemically transformative experience, which is an experience that teaches you something you couldn't have learned without having that kind of experience. And there the thought is that the kind of experience you have teaches you what it's like, and by extension, giving us new abilities to imagine, recognize, and cognitively model possible future mental states for yourself. Then a personally transformative experience is an experience that changes you in some deep and personally fundamental way, perhaps by changing your core personal preferences or by changing the way that you understand your desires and your perspective. And what I'm especially interested in then are experiences and choices concerning those experiences that combine the epistemic and personal dimension. So what I take transformative experiences to be then are experiences that are at once epistemically and personally transformative. And then there's a question with how we make decisions to undergo these kinds of experiences. So I'll give you a couple of examples, the ones that you mentioned, the vampire case and the Mary case, just to see maybe how this would work. Okay, right. So now I'll give you the vampire case first. Imagine that you have a one-time-only chance to become a vampire. So the idea is with one swift, painless bite, you're permanently transformed into an elegant and fabulous creature of the night. And suppose that all of your friends, all the people whose interests, views, and lives are similar to yours have already decided to become vampires. And all of them tell you that they love it. And this is because you get all this amazing new range of sense experiences. You look fabulous in your black clothing. You're incredibly strong and fast and powerful. You're immortal. We can also say, just to elide some of the obvious moral worries, that vampires today, you know, drink blood either from blood banks or they drink blood from humanely farmed animals. So they're not going out and murdering people. Right. It's just a chance to become an entirely different kind of person. So I take vampires are people too. Now, when you talk to your friends and relatives, they say things like, I'd never go back, even if I could. Life has meaning. It has a sense of purpose now that it never had when I was human. You know, they say, wow, it's fabulous, but I can't really explain it to you. You are merely human. You have to become a vampire yourself to know what it's like. All right. So that's the example. And the question that I pose in the book is, say, well, look, would you do it? Because if you're interested in what your future is going to be like, and I think most of us are interested in what our futures are going to be like, how could you possibly make an informed, rational choice to become a vampire? And the reason why I think this is a problem, because you can't know what it's like to become a vampire until you become one. So given the definitions I gave you earlier, the experience of becoming a vampire is transformative. That is, it's an experience that's both radically new, such that you have to have it to know what it will be like for you, and it's going to change your core personal preferences. So if you can't possibly know what it would be like before you try it, and you can't possibly know what you'd be missing if you didn't, how can you rationally choose to do it? And conversely, how can you rationally choose to avoid it if you want to choose based on what you think your future lived experience as a vampire would be like. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and the thought is, and I'll go to the Black and White Mary case in a minute, is that when we're confronted with these kinds of cases, like a fictional case, you can see, I think, what the puzzle is. But then the further thought is that we'll talk about probably in a minute, is that this structure actually generalizes to real life cases, especially real life cases when we're making major life decisions. Mm-hmm. Now, I think anyone who's familiar with discussions in philosophy of mind will see a parallel here between the case I just described and my notion of an epistemically transformative experience and discussions in philosophy of mind involving Black and White Mary, Frank Jackson's famous case of Mary who was raised in a black and white room and then leaves the room and sees color for the first time, or Tom Nagel's ideas about, you know, what it would be like to be a bat, or what it would be like for a cockroach to taste an omelet is something else another example he raised. And the thought is, look, there's a natural and intuitive way in which we see how experience teaches us things that we really can't know in other ways, at least not if we don't have kind of simulation machines, or not if we can't kind of have our brains activated in funky ways by scientists. And also, I'm assuming that, you know, we're talking about ordinary people and not neuroscientists like Mary, who know all of the theory there is to know about the brain and color and everything else. So let's say we know all the science we know currently, but we don't know complete science. Okay, so it's not a debate about physicalism, even though the Nagel and the Jackson cases really are focused on questions about physicalism. Rather, the thought is, look, we can understand that before Mary leaves her black and white room, that she isn't able in an important way to grasp from a phenomenal perspective what it's like to see color. And if she's thinking about her future life in imaginative terms, namely she's attempting to imaginatively model her different possible futures when she's trying to make a decision about whether or not she wants to leave her room, then how is she supposed to do that along the dimension that we really think is quite important, namely along the dimension of what it's really going to be like for her to live one of those possible futures that she's thinking about selecting. So when we say that Mary doesn't know what it's like to see red before she leaves her black and white room and sees a red fire engine, we don't mean that, for example, she doesn't know which of many experiences, phenomenal redness, phenomenal greenness, or phenomenal blueness that she's going to have when she sees the fire engine. What we mean is that she can't imaginatively prefigure what it's like to see red. And in this sense, she can't imaginatively prefigure the nature of her future lived experience as, you know, living outside in a colorful world.
Right. So, great. And I take it that the Mary case will be familiar. So can you say a little bit more, though, about sort of what you've been hinting at, which is that our standard models and maybe even our intuitive sense of rational decision making will fail in these kinds of cases. Then I'm going to ask you to tell me more about the ways in which the structure that seems obviously at work in the vampire and the Mary case actually generalizes. I'll ask you about that in a minute. Tell us a little bit about how our sort of conception of rational choice making isn't going to be of help in the vampire or in the Mary case.
Okay, great. So, there are two, I think, really interesting issues for basically a kind of normative theory of rational decision making. And I say normative in the sense of when we want to try to think in formal epistemological terms of a kind of first personal decision model where we're looking to identify what the gold standard is for acting, namely, you know, how should we in principle make our decisions? There are two problems raised, I think, by transformative experience. The first problem involves, and it's, I think, apparent with the Black and White Mary case, the situation that the agent is in before she's undergone the transformative experience is one where I think it's easiest to say she just lacks a value function. Now, she might have certain kinds of values she could assign. Maybe there are objective moral values involved in leaving one's room, or social values or something like that. But what I'm talking about is the value of what it's going to be like for her to live her future life. So, you know, the value of her lived experience for her. It's a kind of self-interested decision whether or not she wants to leave her black and white room and go out into the colorful world. And the key to understanding the problem, the first problem for decision making, is that when you build a model for rational choice or a decision theoretic model, you need to be able to assign values to the outcomes. There are lots of decision theoretic models for deciding under conditions of ignorance, but the kinds of standard conditions involving ignorance are ignorance of the probabilities involved for the outcomes or the credences. And so you can't calculate how to maximize your expected value in a simple way if you don't know what the probabilities are for the different possible outcomes. But the worry that I'm raising is different, because it's not just probabilities or credences that matter. It's also the values for the outcome, right?
Right.
And in these cases, what I'm saying is that Mary can't cognitively represent to herself the character of the outcomes in any way that's going to allow her to assign values. Because even the models for ignorance, where they assume, well, what are we going to do if we don't know the probabilities? There are really, you know, important models that people use in those conditions. They all assume that you can assign values. And the ignorance models function by representing basically the structure of the value space of the outcomes for a decision problem, right? And in cases where we're ignorant of how likely the outcomes are, they help us to see how to make certain kinds of trade-offs. That's how it works. But if we don't have the values, if we don't have psychologically any way to represent those values, you might say, I'm inclined to say that it's even problematic to say psychologically that Mary has preferences about the different outcomes because she can't even represent them clearly enough to herself, then you can't even use the models to do what you want. So the problem in the first case with the epistemically transformative experiences involves the problem of being able to kind of construct and use a model that's going to allow you to do what you want to do. And so I say, look, you can't make the choice rationally if you can't even build a model, a decision theoretic model that's going to allow you to do what you need to do.
Right. But is the vampire case then more complicated?
Yes.
Because it looks as if the vampire case isn't just a case in which somebody is deciding to undergo an experience that's going to have this profound impact on what they know or how they can interact with the world. The vampire case looks as if not only is there this sort of inability to conceive or to properly understand the gravity of the values, but there's a more fundamental change in the vampire case. Is that right?
Absolutely. So the vampire case brings in the second problem for decision making, and then and the two problems, which I'll tell you about the second one in a second, the second problem, and then when you combine the first and second problem together, I think that's when you get the kind of 1-2 punch that I'm most interested in.
Great.
So the second issue for decision making involves the kind of self change that's involved in these personally transformative experiences. So the thought is, look, as individuals, we're encapsulated at each time we make a decision with respect to our preferences at that time, including our higher order preferences. So I might prefer now to be human and prefer to be human, et cetera, et cetera. But the thing is that when you undergo the personally transformative experience, your preferences will change and possibly even your higher order preferences will change so that the person that you'd become might have preferences that are entirely different from what your preferences are now. And so the question is, when you have an agent that's basically personally quite different with different personal preferences at different times, how do you, including higher order preferences, how do you adjudicate between those two temporal slices, which agent matters more? So, and this has been discussed in the decision theoretic literature, but I think it's been discussed in highly stylized cases where the thought is, well, if you have these two different sets of preferences, the first assumption is often been, well, maybe we can just go higher order and make a decision. But in my cases, the higher order preferences often change as well. So you don't have any kind of simple decision rule that you can apply to adjudicate. So, you know, you're human and you're thinking about being a vampire and you know that right now you want to be human, but you also know that if you became a vampire, you'd be really glad that you became a vampire, and which individual matters more. And if we just say, well, it's permissible to do everything, then that's not very satisfying because we want a decision rule. We want to know what we're supposed to do, not that, you know, we can just kind of anything goes. When we're making big life changes, we want a rule. Okay, so that's the second issue that comes up with the vampire choice. But what really matters, I think, is when you combine the fact that you're facing an identity change problem, yet because it's an identity change involving becoming a kind of person a kind of person that you can't right now cognitively model or connect from the first person. So you can't understand from the inside how you're going to change and respond to that experience, right? Then you can't step back and try to model the different possible choices, becoming a vampire, not becoming a vampire, and make a decision about which you'd prefer, because you simply don't have access to what your futures are going to be like. So not only is it the case that the way that you're going to end up might be inconsistent with what you care about now, but also you can't even know what that person's perspective, your future self's perspective is going to be, so that you can compare, you know, mentally your perspective now with what your perspective would be then in order to try to make an informed choice.
Right. So this is helpful. So the The vampire case, then, let me just sort of make sure I've got it. The vampire case, then, is, so would it be wrong to say something like, here's this extra problem with the vampire case. It's a funny thought to have, you know, what would it be like for me to suddenly not be disgusted by the thought of drinking blood?
Right.
You might say, how is that, how is that sort of imaginative sort of thought? What would it be like for me? How is that different from just imagining somebody else who's a vampire?
Right.
All right. Excellent. So when we're confronted with the choice whether to be a vampire, we're not just confronted with the choice of, to undergo an experience, which is going to give us information of a new and uncognizable kind, uncognizable to us at present kind. It's sort of a more fundamental change in the kind of creature that we are, so that we become a fundamentally different kind of thing that we can't cognize.
That's right.
Great. Good. So we've been talking about these two fanciful cases, the vampire and the Frank Jackson's case of Mary. But one of the really exciting things in the book is the reveal that is these are just fanciful examples of a really common choice structure that we face. So can you tell us a little bit about the real life examples that have this kind of structure?
Yes. So my personal favorite case is the case of becoming a parent. So I argue in the book, and I've argued in a separate paper as well, that the choice to have your first child is effectively just like the choice of whether or not to become a vampire.
There's even a lot, folks, there's even a lot in the book. Parents are a lot more like vampires than we feel.
Yes, my daughter recently Googled me and discovered a YouTube video where I talk about this, and I had some explaining to do. And let me kind of back up for a second and tell you and build the case a little bit. So, sure. So now here's for anyone who has a couple of children, the following kind of dilemma might be familiar, and that is, look, you have two children, and you decide, I know what it's like not to be a parent. I've had a couple of kids, but I'm thinking, do I want to have a third child? And you know that, you know, you love your two children now, and you love your situation now. This is a stylized case, but I think it's close enough to, I think a lot of people have been in this situation. But they also know that if they have a third child, they'll love that third child too, and they'll be very glad that they have a third child. But the case I'm imagining is where someone is quite happy to have two children and doesn't want to have a third child, but also knows that if they did have a third child, that they'd be very happy to be a parent with three children. Mm-hmm. And what's going on here is that there's an identity, there's an attachment relation that you form to a child that you produce that's identity changing in an interesting way. You're the parent of that child, and you're connected to that child with its particular characteristics in a special way. And you love that child if you respond in a normal way. And you can think of that kind of dilemma as a version of the personally transformative choice, the case I mentioned where the decision problem is where here you are as an agent at before you make a decision, you have your preferences, and say you prefer to have two children and you prefer to have two children. But you know if something happens and you have a third child that you'll prefer to be someone with three children and prefer to be someone with three children, and et cetera. That kind of case is not far-fetched. Many people are in that situation. And the question is, well, look, is there some kind of rational way of deciding whether or not to have a third child? And right. It seems like there isn't a straightforward answer. And that's even when the epistemic questions are sort of set to one side. Okay. So now let's back up. Let's say you have no children. My argument basically is that, look, the process, first the process of sort of physically as a woman growing inside a child inside you and producing that child, I think is an incredibly distinctive physical process. It's a very human and gritty process. And it involves experiences I think that one really can't have in any other sort of ordinary situation. And then I think that's one part of physically producing a child. But then there's just being a parent of a child And in the book, I talk about a child that you've produced, although I think that there's a different version of the case for people that adopt children. Mm-hmm. But in the case I'm thinking about, you physically grow and produce a child inside you, you give birth to the child, and then you parent the child. And the ordinary way that people respond to this, to being in this situation, is to become very personally attached to the child that they produce. So the thought is that standing in this distinctive parent-child attachment relation, it's a distinctive loving arrangement, is both epistemically transformative. It's a kind of experience that is very distinctive and isn't, in the relevant sense, like other kinds of experiences we ordinarily have. I don't think it's the same as, you know, having a little sister. I don't think it's the same as having a cat. I think it's distinctively different in important ways. And it also changes us first personally. It's personally transformative as well. And if that's right, then the choice to become a parent for the first time is, like the vampire case, both epistemically and personally transformative. So that rational problem I mentioned with the second kid to third kid situation is embedded in the first situation I mentioned. Namely, you can't, I think, cognitively model forward how you're going to respond to being in this basically deep and fundamental attachment relation to this child that you produce. And because it's going to change your preferences in all kinds of ways, I think that you have to have the experience to be able to know how significantly it's going to infuse into your life. And these personal preferences that you have after you produce the child are really going to be quite different. I think many people reflect quite differently on how they organize their lives, on how they think about their careers, what they want to do with their lives, how they spend their time. All of those things are really dramatically different after you produce a child. So the thought is, look, the same structure that you see in the vampire case is present in the choice to have your first child. And that means that the same problems arise. Namely, how are you supposed to construct a decision theoretic model where you can look at the different possible outcomes, assign them values, and then calculate how you're supposed to maximize your expected value in this situation? How are you supposed to do that? You can't perform this task because you can't construct a model that will allow you to get the, you know, answer that you need about how to maximize expected value. And therefore, you can't make the choice rationally if you want to make a choice to have your first child based on what you think it's going to be like to have the lived experience of being a parent.
And if you can't make the choice rationally, it also seems that, you know, you can't decline on rational grounds. So we're condemned to a kind of irrationality. Is that right?
Well, I absolutely think that's right. You can't decline based on thinking, well, I know what it would be like to be a parent, and that's not something that I want, right? Because I don't think you can know, just like you can't decline to become a vampire because you know what it's going to be like to be a vampire, and you know that's something you don't want. What I say is that it's not rational. I wouldn't go so far as to say it's irrational because I think basically right. There's no model. So that's, it's just not apt to call it a rational choice. I do have suggestions, which maybe we'll get to.
Sure.
But I'm not sure that any of my suggestions are really especially satisfying, to be honest.
So the decision about whether to become a parent is one of these transformative experience kinds of cases. In the book, you also talk about cases that I take it are more analogous to the Mary case with people who were born deaf and deciding whether to undergo surgery and that will enable them to hear.
That's right. So another kind of case that I think there are a whole bunch of, I basically think that most of the big life decisions that we face end up being both epistemically and personally transformative in the way that I'm thinking. I think, for example, end of life cases are very much like this. So problems come up with advanced directives, for example. But that's right. I talk about interesting cases involving certain kinds of disabilities. And I talk about cochlear implants. And there's another sort of more general case one might think of. Imagine someone who's congenitally blind, and they're a congenitally blind adult, and they have the opportunity to undergo some kind of retinal operation that would allow them to become sighted. And I think it's if we want to think fancifully, we could think, imagine that neuroscientists develop a new chip that you could get implanted in your brain and would give you a sixth sense capacity, like a new kind of sense capacity, different from the five senses that we already have. But the catch is you would also lose one of your sense capacities Maybe you don't know which one you would lose. Maybe you just lose something like your sense of taste. And I think that's a way we can kind of try to understand what the situation would be like for the congenitally blind adult. Because it's not like always just a win-win. It's not like, oh, well, more information is good. That is not how these things work.
Right.
Because there are always significant trade-offs, first of all. Just how the brain works involves would involve significant trade-offs. And second, there are these personal trade-offs. Because if you are an adult and your dominant sensory modality is not seeing, but is, say, hearing or some other sense modality, you've almost certainly built your identity around whatever your dominant sense modality is. That's how people respond to having these kinds of disabilities. The way that you understand and process information, the way your brain has formed, has been determined in part by whatever your dominant sense modality is. And so we're talking about a dramatic experiential difference in the way that you would live your life if you decide to gain a new sense modality. So then it's basically a version of the fictional case I just described where, look, you're going to lose something, maybe your sense of taste, even when you gain this really cool new sense capacity. But we can all see how just telling me I'm going to get someone being told they're going to get a new sense capacity doesn't give them the kind of information that they want about what it's going to be like to have that sensory capacity, because descriptive information just doesn't cut it. We want to be able to grasp it basically phenomenally.
Right. So you, at one point, sort of later in the book, you cast the sort of problem that you're putting your finger on in these cases, and, you know, noting their perhaps unexpected how common they are, perhaps unexpectedly, that we're left with a kind of Sartrean dilemma. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Okay. So I definitely think it's only a kind of Sartrean dilemma because
right.
It's not really Sartre. I mean, it's more that there's a way of thinking about certain kinds of life defining questions as existentialists, basically. And that's what I meant in the book, in that we think of ourselves, especially in modern day society, especially in Western societies, as having a sort of open field of possibilities. And we think of ourselves as being able to make choices that are going to allow us to form ourselves into future selves that we want to be. And also that will allow us to kind of look back and understand how we got to where we are. And the thought is, not only do we want to be able to do that when we make big decisions, but we want to be able to do it authentically. Namely, we want to be able to do it by, in a knowledgeable sense, by being able to imaginatively and properly forecast, at least with respect to the dominant relevant dimensions of the future experience, what our future selves would be like if we decided to undergo various kinds of experiences, like become a parent or become a lawyer or become a philosopher or travel the world. And the thought is that this is a kind that the thought is basically that the questions that I'm raising cast doubt on our ability to actually perform that kind of task. We have this picture of building ourselves, of choosing in an informed and authentic way between possibilities, of constructing a kind of narrative for our lives. And if I'm right, that when you really look at what we try to do and how experience teaches us things, then that picture just doesn't describe the situation that we're really in. And my thought is that we have to confront this fact, and we should understand, basically, that life, instead of life being something where you kind of plan it out and you know imaginatively what you're doing and you guide yourself into different into the futures that you want and realize yourself in the ways that you've planned, that instead life involves a lot more of surprise and discovery in good and bad ways than we thought it did. And if we're successful, what we need to do is decide when we're going to make certain discoveries, and then we learn to live with those. So we discover, for example, what it's like to become a parent, or we discover what it's like to become a philosopher, and then we accommodate ourselves to that. That's, I think, a really important process, is sort of psychologically adapting to the decisions that you make, namely realizing who you've made yourself into and understanding the value of who you've made yourself into.
Right. So can you expand on that? Because one of the conclusions, insofar as the book has conclusions, I mean, is that the way to think about these transformative choices is not in terms of the standard, you know, projection of your utility function into the future, but instead to place some value on the revelatory dimensions of certain kinds of experiences. Can you tell us about the value of revelation?
Sure. So this is part of the connection to metaphysics. So what I'm thinking here is, first I'm thinking about, look, we causally model ourselves into the future. So we model our future selves in an imaginative way. And then I draw on work on color experience. And I'm especially interested in John Campbell and Mark Johnson's work on color experience, where we talk about the value of having different kinds of experiences for their own sake. Now, the way that I want to use revelation is actually different from Campbell and Johnston, but the basic idea is drawn from them, namely that we can see that there's value, intrinsic value, in having and discovering experience for its own sake. And the thought is that if what we do is we discover or allow the world to reveal itself to us. And in a certain way, then we reveal to ourselves who we are, or who we're making ourselves into in virtue of undergoing the experience. And my thought is that that has a certain kind of value. And if you think that that value is good enough, and that's a big if, then we can use that to make rational decisions about these big life-changing situations. So the way that I put it with respect to, say, having a child, is to say, look, you can either think that revelation is good, and so you want to make a discovery about what it's like to be a certain kind of person, or you can reject revelation and endorse the status quo and refuse to make a discovery involving revelation. So in the case of choosing to have a child, you can either say, okay, I don't know what it's going to be like to become a parent, but I want to find out. So I'm going to discover what it's like to become a parent and all the good and bad that entails. Or you could think, no, I know what my life is like now and I like it. I don't want to change it. So I'm going to hold off on discovery. I think that's also perfectly irrational. So you're not going to discover what it's like to become a parent. I don't think that's especially satisfactory as a solution to people pondering whether or not they want to have a child, because I don't think intuitively people are comfortable with that being the sole basis on which they make their decision. But it might be the only thing we can really do.
Right. So, the suggestion then is to think of these choices. Let me see if I'm getting this right. The suggestion is to think of these choices not as an opportunity to pursue or try to maximize some particular value that we project might be inherent in those experiences for us as the creature who has a given set of preferences and all the rest. But to see these experiences as sort of invitations to strike out into the unknown and to become the kind of person who's willing to do that kind of thing?
The thought is that if you have a preference for the value of revelation, then you can choose based on those preferences. In other words, you can prefer revelation or you can disprefer revelation. And so the way to build the model and the relevant outcomes and the value and to assign values to the outcomes can involve revelation, namely the value of discovering the values of the lived experience that you'll end up undergoing, or the value of refusing that, namely the keeping the values that are familiar to you. So the thought is that when you build your model, you have to be really careful about which outcomes you're assigning values to and what you're using to construct your assessment of what the expected utility is for some particular act.
Right.
That's a little bit different, right? So it's like you know, if you prefer to discover revelation, then you prefer to find out what it's like to be this kind of person.
Right. Good. This is a real great puzzle. You've put your finger on something very important. Let me just ask a very quick sort of question, maybe about a meta-ethical implication of the view. Does this suggestion require us to think that certain kinds of experiences have a value that isn't to be measured in the ways that a utilitarian might ask us to think of the value of experiences? That is, are we required to think that some experiences have value? You said earlier intrinsic value, but do you mean value that's not derived from the quantity of pleasure or pain that's produced?
Okay, so there's a way in which, that's right. So the way that I'm thinking about value, it's not anti-consequentialist, but it's definitely anti-hedonic. I just don't think that the way to flesh out the values of lived experiences is just about quantities of pleasure or pain or happiness or sadness. One of the things that I'm really interested in is, and if you look at some of the empirical work on people who have children, involves how people think that sometimes discovering certain kinds of experiences have a kind of value that can increase the level of suffering that you're experiencing, yet still has value in some kind of more meaningful sense. I mean, I take it that's often what parents think. They think, yes, that's right. Now that I've had a child, I'm financially less stable. I get much less sleep. I feel overwhelmed. I'm anxious. I'm exhausted. I have less time for work, right? Less time for my spouse. All of these things seem like standard negatives. However, they'll also say, but I'm really glad I did it, and it's such a meaningful experience. So how does that comport? Well, one way to make sense of that is to say, well, obviously, there's another dimension of value here that we need to be able to respect. Now, if we can identify what that is, that I think is consistent with a kind of consequentialist picture. It's just not consistent with a kind of simple picture where it's all about pleasure or pain.
Right. So the book ends then with an appendix where you take up in serial fashion some lingering concerns that in some places, at least as I was reading, it sounded like these were objections that people had raised to some of these ideas. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the sort of lingering issues that you think are most important to follow up on?
Sure. Sorry. So the afterword does two things. It takes up a number of technical issues that I thought were interesting and worth exploring, but would have sort of diverted attention in the main part of the book, because the main part, as you sort of alluded to, the book is really an essay that raises questions more than doesn't really propose answers. Although I do at the end develop a model based on revelation that we might want to employ to make choices rationally. And in the afterword, I talk about, for example, I talk about the possibility that, well, maybe we can model some of these worries using, say, imprecise credences, which imprecise credences are kind of hot topic for formal epistemologists. And I respond by saying, well, I don't think imprecise credences are really the issue here. But there is a related, really interesting discussion that I've been having, in particular with Richard Pettigrew and some other people, including John Collins and Rachel Briggs, about how we might be able to model rationally some of these transformative experiences. And the real question is, I alluded to this in the beginning, is can we push the fact that we don't have a value function in cases where, say, when Mary's thinking about leaving her black and white room, can we, even if Mary can't represent the values that are relevant, does it matter in the end if an expert came along and just told Mary, well, this is, you know, these are the different values for the different possible outcomes. So I've calculated it all for you. So this is what you should do. You know, how much does it really matter if Mary can't formulate these things for herself? And I think it does matter. And so one issue involves the question of authenticity. And as I mentioned before, I think it's really important to us that as individuals, we don't just do what we're told, right? We want to take the testimony of the expert, but then we want to reflect on who we are and how we think we'll respond to the experience in question and be able to think of how we would model ourselves forward. And if we can't do that, then there's a way in which, because we can't see the outcomes, we have to just kind of follow what the expert tells us to do. I don't think that we're in any kind of scientific situation where, in fact, we would have the information that we need, so that there is no expert advice that's good enough as it happens. But even if there were expert advice that I think that was actually good enough, that could tell me in my situation, right, what the outcomes would be for me if I underwent the decision, if I underwent the experience, I think first there'd be a problem with authenticity, because I wouldn't be choosing to form my future in the informed way that I think we should. And there's a second problem. And the second problem is that, this actually came out in a debate I had with Paul Bloom, that when I'm making my choice before I undergo this massive transformative experience, I care about certain things. And if the expert tells me, oh, well, once you've undergone the experience, if you do this, if you take choice, you know, behind door A, you'll have a utility of 10. And if you take, you know, door B, you'll have a utility of 5, right? What I don't know is who the person who's gone through that door is in a certain way. Is that person still who I am now?
Right.
Or is that person, to all effects and purposes, a vampire?
Mm-hmm.
And so if I don't know that, then I don't know. And the expert doesn't know that either. The expert just has just assessed the different people behind the doors and given me the answers. Right. And so I haven't solved the problem just by knowing what the results will be, just by knowing the utility values, because I can't perform that intuitive first personal modeling to be sure that as I morph into the person behind the door, that I'm still me in the sense that matters.
Right. So you've been very generous with your time, Laurie. I wanted to make sure we had time just to follow up on some of what you were just mentioning. So I imagine that this book is already generating a lot of discussion. And so are you planning to follow up on some of this stuff with, further work? And if so, where are those discussions taking you?
Uh-huh. So the Journal of Philosophy and Phenomenological Research is doing a book symposium. And,
oh, great.
Yeah, it's great. And Richard Pettigrew has written a comment, and Elizabeth Barnes and John Campbell are all contributing. So that's a really nice, I think it's going to be a really nice discussion, and would be of interest to anybody who's interested in the project. I also am working on developing these ideas. So I was emphasizing, as we talked about, imaginative connections to our future selves. I've got all these empirical projects that I'm collaborating with psychologists and cognitive scientists on. And so there's another book in the works, basically. And the second book is going to be all about how these issues, I think, connect really rather deeply to our notions of causal and temporal experience and how we think of ourselves in anticipatory ways and how we can make sense of who we are, but from a very kind of contemporary analytic perspective that's also empirically informed.
Well, wonderful. I'll definitely keep an eye out for the for both of those things that you mentioned. The PPR issue sounds like, just the people involved are great. So it sounds like that'll be wonderful.
There's one more
and
thing.
The book.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, sure.
Oh, and there's also there's also a Res Philosophica issue, a special issue of the journal Res Philosophica that's devoted to this topic as well. That's where the paper, What You Can't Expect When You're Expecting, is coming out.
Which should win an award for just the title.
There are a number of contributors there, and they have lots of different things to say. There's a lot of interesting people contributing to that as well. And so if people are interested in the topic, that would be another place to look.
Well, that sounds wonderful. Laurie, you've been very generous. Thank you so much for appearing on New Books in Philosophy to talk about your new book, Transformative Experience.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to my interview with Professor L.A. Paul of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We were talking about her new book, Transformative Experience, which is newly published by Oxford University Press. I'm Robert Talese, your host. This is New Books in Philosophy. Thank you for listening.